Now, in a moment, a Friday conversation with one of America's greatest playwrights, Edward Albee. But first, American and Iranian diplomats are scheduled to hold their first direct talks in years in Baghdad on Monday. The topic, stabilizing Iraq. Despite those talks, both President Bush and his Iranian counterpart continue to trade tough words about Iran's nuclear ambitions, and the Pentagon has moved two U.S. aircraft carrier groups to the Persian Gulf. Meanwhile, the fate of at least four Iranian Americans recently detained by the Iranian government hangs in the balance. Two are scholars, one a journalist, another a California businessman. Well, joining us from Washington is Karim Sajapour, an Iran expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Karim, the Washington Post headlined these detentions as the new Iranian hostage crisis, writing that it's unleashing the same passions in the U.S. as when 52 Americans were taken hostage 25 years ago. But do you think that's true? It seems many Americans don't even know this story.
Well, I think that it's obviously not the same as the U.S. embassy in Tehran being overtaken and having these 52 Americans abducted for 444 days like it was in 1979-80. But this time around, it's equally harrowing simply because you have this small group at the moment of Iranian-American scholars, especially the two that you mentioned in the Washington Post piece, Hala Esfandiari and Kian Tajbakhsh, who, as I mentioned, both are U.S. nationals and both have been involved in the realm of scholarship on Iran, and both of them had always written in the past very favorably about having dialogue and engagement with Iran. And I think for those of us who work on these issues of Iran analysis, internal Iranian politics, it's very harrowing to think that our colleagues are in solitary confinement in jail right now.
You mentioned the 45-year-old Tajbakhsh, an urban planning expert working in Iran with philanthropist George Soros' Open Society Institute. He was detained on May 11th. You mentioned 67-year-old Esfandiari, who is director of the Middle East program for the think tank, the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars. She was visiting her sick mother, but she has been, speaking to women in the Middle East about gaining more rights. Why do you think Iran has detained them?
Well, there's several possibilities. I think it's certainly within the realm of possibilities that the Iranian government is trying to send a stern message to the Bush administration that they should cease democracy promotion efforts in Iran. That if the U.S. wants to continue to talk about democracy and civil society in Iran, there's going to be serious repercussions. I think at the same time, the Iranian government is sending a signal to scholars and activists, especially dual nationals, to tread very carefully, and especially in terms of limiting their contact with foreign actors or foreign NGOs. But I think it's also within the realm of possibilities that there is this small clique of actors among the political elite in Iran, and I would say they're a minority, but they're quite a powerful minority at the moment. And they have entrenched interests, both political and financial interests, in retaining Iran's status quo isolation. So anytime we see a prospect of a warming of ties between Iran and the West, or a dialogue between the U.S. and Iran, such as what is scheduled to take place on Monday, we see these hardliners in Tehran try to torpedo these talks.
Possibly thinking that the talks would have been called off because of the detentions. Well, you mentioned Iran accusing the U.S. of trying to bring democracy to Iran. Last year, Condoleezza Rice did announce allocation of $75 million for democracy promotion in Iran. We've heard that even Iranian reformers have said that that announcement made their work harder because it made them suspicious in the eyes of the Iranian government. Are you hearing that as well? And are any of your friends funded by the U.S. government?
Well, first of all, neither Kian nor Hala Esfandiari have ever taken any money from the U.S. government. Kian is only loosely affiliated with the Soros Open Society Institute. He has also done consulting work with the World Bank, and has actually even done consulting work for the Iranian government themselves. But it is true that agitators for democracy and reform in Iran are concerned that this type of U.S. funding, or the U.S. earmarking $75 million for democracy promotion in Iran, undermines their efforts, because the Iranian government can more easily paint them as foreign lackeys.
What do these detentions mean for Iranian Americans who may want to travel to Iran? I mean, what's the talk of the community here?
Well, I think it's sent a huge chill over the entire community, or even people who are not really not at all involved in political activities. I think certainly those people, scholars who used to travel back and forth to Iran freely, I can think of very few who have any plans to go back at the moment. And again, I think even people who were going back who had no involvement, either in scholarly work or remotely involved in political work, are also thinking twice. So I think if the goal of the Iranian government was to further isolate Iran from the international community and to hinder contact between Iranians in the diaspora and Iranians within Iran, they've certainly achieved that.
Do you think that this will be on the table at the talks on Monday, which are supposed to be just about stabilizing Iraq, but do you have a sense that this will come up?
I think if it comes up, it will be done privately. On one hand, I think the Americans do want to bring up their cases, but I think on the other hand, there is a concern that they want to keep the cases of these individuals isolated from the broader political disputes.
Iran expert Karim Sajjadpour, an associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
The expected blockbuster Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End is sailing into theaters across the country today, with other summer blockbusters close behind. You may be headed for the Cineplex this weekend, but this summer, are you also considering the Playhouse? We recently fell into a conversation about live theater with one of America's best playwrights. Edward Albee's won 3 Pulitzer Prizes, a Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement, and a National Medal of the Arts for his body of work, including The Goat or Who is Sylvia, Tiny Alice, and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was turned into a highly acclaimed Hollywood film starring Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor as George and Martha, a college professor and his wife, with a marriage marked by verbal sparring.
You make me puke.
It wasn't a very nice thing to say, Martha.
That wasn't what?
A very nice thing to say.
Oh, I like your anger. I think that's what I like about you most. Your anger. You're such a simp. You haven't even got the what?
Guts?
Phrase maker.
What makes a good play? What makes audiences flock to it, especially when they have their own home theaters, not to mention the multiplex? Why is Albee's Zoo Story, written in 1958, still drawing crowds?
I've been to the zoo. I said I've been to the zoo. Mister, I've been to the zoo.
Hmm? What? I'm sorry, were you talking to me?
The Zoo Story, heard here in a Hartford Stage Company production. Well, playwright Edward Albee happened to be considering the future of American theater when we spoke one day last month. He was part of a forum here in Boston asking if there is one, a future, that is. Albee's answer.
Oh, it depends on so many things. It depends upon whether we ever start educating people in the arts again in our school system. We've stopped doing that almost totally. Right. Right. Unless we can have a society that cares something about the arts and is informed about the arts, you can't possibly have people going to see serious theater or dance or anything.
You know, I forgot about that. You know, we were forced to put on some of the dramas in middle school and high school, and now look on back on that with joy.
Yeah, but the kids just aren't educated anymore. But the reason there's always going to be theater is that live theater, that's what I'm talking about, theater on stage, mm-hmm. is the thing that distinguishes live theater from television and film, is that live theater is happening to you while you are there. It is a real experience as opposed to a synthetic experience.
And a passive one.
Yes. You always know that film and television aren't true. And in theater, there's that wonderful phrase, suspension of disbelief. Mm. You never suspend your disbelief in television or film. Mm. But if something is really working on stage and it's a live performance and you're there, you lose contact with the fact that these are a bunch of actors pretending to be people, mm. and it's a fake set and everything, and all of a sudden you're in a real situation. And you don't get much reality in society anymore. You certainly don't get much reality in the arts.
What are some of the practical aspects, though? I mean, let's say you know about theater, but what are some of the practical problems confronting theaters? I've heard, read you speak of cost.
The costs of everything have gone up terribly. That's because, well, I don't even want to talk about why, but...
What are some of the reasons why? I'll quote you. You say that when Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was first staged, I think I have this right, it was $45,000. Now
on Broadway, yes.
Yeah, sure there was inflation, but now...
And the inflation has not kept up with the rise of theater costs. The last production we did on Broadway, which is touring in San Francisco right now, cost $1.5 million. Mm. Everybody's salaries have gone up, of course, but the cost of renting theaters have gone up. The cost of advertising in the newspapers and on television and on radio has gone up so much more than anything else. One-third of a budget for a play now is
really?
Advertising.
One-third.
You know, even off-Broadway, where I started and where I started seeing theater long before I wrote plays, was $2 and $3 to get into a performance. Now it's $75-$80, even off-Broadway. And kids can't get there. Young people can't get there a lot.
Is part of the increase in the cost of seeing a play, increase in the ticket, that people want to make more money off of theater than they used to?
Well, there's not that much money to be made from theater, except every once in a while some lugubrious and terrible musical will come along and run for 7 or 8 years, and people make a bunch of money off of that. But that's not theater, that's manufacturing.
I've shared with you that I had a short theater experience in a play here in Boston, and I was astonished at, you know, the actors who... the commitments they made for the little money that they made, mm-hmm, in return.
Sure.
And it's true, of course, of playwrights as well. You spoke to a master class, 4 high school students at the Museum of Modern Art. What about them? What about playwrights? What are some of the things, you know, they have to do to ensure theater's future? How do they make better theater?
They have to be willing to stay with theater in spite of the blandishments of television and film, where they can, at least in theory, make a great deal more money, even though they'll lose their souls doing it.
I was going to say, do you think you can do both, or does it corrupt your playwright?
You can't do both, basically, because you have absolutely no control over your own work when you write for television and film. There are other people that are constantly changing your work without your permission. The great thing about being a playwright is nobody can change a word of what you've written without your permission.
Mm. Although you've said they will try to make you take a play that's perfectly happy at 3.5 hours and make it 2 hours.
They will, but that's commercial. That's commerce.
Right.
Unless you give in to the blandishments of commerce and hold the fact that this is a serious play and it's a certain length and it's about certain things, and I'm not going to make it simpler to reach the simple-minded. I've written this play for people of a certain intelligence and who wish to participate in something that's not going to make them giddy necessarily, except giddy with self-awareness maybe, which is great. And they have to do it on my terms. Hmm. That's the nice thing about theater. You don't have to sell out.
We'll be back with American playwright Edward Albee in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
What do I find most astonishing, aside from that belief of mine, which never ceases to surprise me by the very fact of its surprising lack of unpleasantness, the belief that I might very easily, as they say, lose my mind one day, not that I suspect I'm about to, or I'm even nearby.
So begins Edward Albee's play, A Delicate Balance, as performed by members of the Trinity Repertory Company in Providence, Rhode Island. We're back with more of our conversation with Edward Albee, which we had when he was in Boston last month to attend a forum pondering the question, does live theater have a future? We asked Albee about the advice he gives to young playwrights. We'd read about a master class he taught for 4 high school students and put together a list of his pointers, beginning with, don't write too soon. Get to know your characters.
Yeah, so many people start off and they think they've got a wonderful idea. And so they'll start writing and page 42, they stop. They don't really know what they're doing. They haven't let it gestate. It hasn't thought through yet.
Well, you gave us an extreme example of that when we spoke a couple of years ago when you were on the program. The example involves your play, The Zoo Story, with 2 men meeting around a park bench.
One of whom ends up dead by the end
of
the play.
Yes, there's that. And there was a sequel of sorts, second act, if you will, called Home Life.
Well, actually, the Home Life is the first act of the two-act play, the Zoo Story being the second act.
But you wrote Home Life second.
I wrote Home Life 42 years after I wrote the Zoo Story because I realized I had two characters on stage in the Zoo Story, one of whom is called Jerry, who talks all the time, and we know everything about him. We don't learn very much about Peter, the publisher who was sitting in the park. And I wanted to know more about him. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting? Also, whenever the Zoo Story is done, I have to approve of whatever play is being done with it. And I get so tired of having to approve of plays. I said, gee, if I write a play,
which is
the first act, I don't have to approve anything anymore because I've got to do the two together. And so I hadn't thought about the character Peter ever since I wrote the Zoo Story 40-some years ago. But I started writing this play about Peter at home with his wife, Anne, whom I'd never met.
In your head.
But I had her there.
Did you? That's what I mean.
I had her there because even when I wrote the Zoo Story, Peter had a wife, and obviously I knew who she was. But with going back to revisiting Peter, it was so simple to do. I knew who he was. I knew who his wife Anne was. I knew everything about where they lived, their environment. Right. I kept it in my head all those years, which is interesting.
So there's number one on the list, get to know your characters.
You really have to know them.
Perhaps not keep them in your head for 47 years.
Well, you don't have to keep them talking to you all the time, but as long as you have them there and you can bring them back, that's fine.
Here's some other things that Edward Albee said. You said to these students, write absolutely real people in real situations.
Well, unless you're going to write a real three-dimensional character, you're writing an essay. And unless you can write dialogue that is true to a real situation, you're faking it. You're writing ideas rather than people.
Let's see. Never lecture. Don't be obscure. Never become someone's opinion of you.
No, never do that. No, never allow yourself. I tell my students, every time you write a play, whether it's your second play or your 30th play, it's the first play you've ever written. You've got to begin all over again each time. So you're not influenced by what you've done. And you don't imitate yourself consciously or unconsciously.
So you cannot be, when you sit down and write, you cannot think of yourself as Edward Albee, one of America's greatest playwrights, master of the acerbic dialogue as illustrated in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
No, of course not. Yeah. No, I'm writing my first play. I'd be burdened by comparisons, and I don't want to do that myself.
Just finishing out the list, you tell these young writers, every line has two purposes. One to delineate character, the other to advance the plot. Everything else is waste.
Yeah. You can't just go around wasting time. Plays exist in present time. And if you're vamping or wasting time, people become aware of it and they turn off and don't participate.
Four essential playwrights to read. Who are they?
The great 20th century playwrights, as far as I'm concerned, Chekhov, Pirandello, Brecht, and Beckett.
But you say read junk, too.
Well, I tell students, if they're starting out, if they only read masterpieces, they're going to get pretty discouraged. But if they read some junk, they'll say, wow, I can do at least as good as that. Huh. So that's terribly encouraging. And also, reading plays teaches you what to do and what not to do. And if you don't read junk, you won't know what not to do.
Edward Albee, the last time we spoke, you told us that you were in a rage about the Iraq War, and this was 2 years ago.
Not only about the Iraq War, but the duplicity and incompetence and depravity of the present administration, yes.
You said at the time that you might address that in a play.
Yes, but I don't want to write a play that turns into an essay or agitprop. I write plays so that people will think about themselves and stop behaving in ways that will allow them to vote for people like that.
Currently on Broadway, we've got Tom Stoppard's Coast of Utopia, The Year of Magical Thinking, based on Joan Didion's memoir, Angela Lansbury's Return in Terrence McNally's Deuce.
And Marion Seldes.
Yes. It sounds healthy. We started by saying, do you think it has
three, a future? 3 out of 70?
Yeah. There's that.
Yeah.
There's that. Who do you like? Who are you watching and saying, this is our future?
Oh, I always hate that list.
Okay.
There's so many young... Here's the problem. The problem in our theater is not the quality of the young playwrights. We've got so many good ones. The problem is that audiences sometimes don't want to be involved in plays that are serious. They don't want to take chances with unknown people. The problem is the combination of audiences and critics who don't give these young people a fair shake. Most people want to go and see some piece of junk that they, you know, they spent 60 or 200 bucks between the two of them to go see it, plus the babysitter, plus dinner, you know, $300 or $400 to go see something in which nothing has happened to you. You haven't learned anything. Nothing has changed about the way you perceive things. What a terrible waste of time.
Playwright Edward Albee, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Good to see you again.
We spoke with Albee last month here in Boston. Some of the modern-day plays we mentioned have since closed. Well, looking ahead to Memorial Day, we'll speak with two mothers with a painful bond, sons who didn't come home from Iraq. Still ahead, a Marine who says he's scared, he's not a hero, but he's volunteering to go back to Iraq for his fourth tour of duty. That's after the news, here and now. What compels Marines and soldiers to serve in Iraq beyond their initial call of duty? The Los Angeles Times reports this week on the Marine 2nd Battalion 5th Regiment, in which 200 Marines volunteered to extend their stays in Iraq to help mentor their younger comrades. Well, Marine Captain Seth Moulton has also volunteered to return to Iraq for his fourth tour of duty. Seth is a Harvard grad from Marblehead, Massachusetts. He was discharged from active service last year and is now a reservist. His unit isn't being recalled. Seth is volunteering to work directly for and support his old boss, the man who's now commanding general in Iraq, David Petraeus. We welcome back Seth, who's been a frequent guest on Here and Now. And Seth, why else did you decide to go back?
It's tough. It's not an easy thing to go back, but I think that as badly as the war is going, it's still very important. It's a very important problem. And I think a lot of people's kind of instinctive reaction is if things are going badly, then maybe that's a time to stay away. But I think that's when, you know, it's most important to serve. General Petraeus has assured me that he'll have something worthwhile for me to do, and as long as there are fellow young Americans serving in Iraq and there's something I can do to contribute, then I'm happy to do that.
Is part of it because of General Petraeus?
It is, I think.
So it's the pull of a leader that's drawing you back. But I'm wondering also if Marines such as yourself are also thinking, go my own way, or, you know, maybe get pulled back in a year, you know, through deployment.
Well, I'll tell you what, I have an awful lot of friends who got out of the Marine Corps like I did, got off active duty, and were just in the inactive reserves, and just in the past month have been recalled, and they have very little control over what they do. This way, at least, I know I'll be doing something, I know who I'll be working for, and I know it'll be worthwhile.
Will it? I mean, what do you say to people who say, geez, it's a, you know, we are going to get out of there as soon as we can, it's a lost cause? Do you have these conversations as you're home in this area? You know, what do people say to you?
I do. I mean, it's hard for a lot of people to understand why I want to go back, because they think it's just a vote of confidence in the policy or something like that, rather than a sincere desire to serve. And understanding that as bad as things are, we've got to find a way out of this. You know, one of the things that people forget is that, you know, if you disagree with this war, if you go to Iraq and you're out in the ground, I mean, you have influence over people's lives. Iraqis and Americans, and that's very important. And you know, as long as other Americans are there doing it, I feel like I should continue to do my part.
How will you gauge, you know, whether it was worthwhile? Let's say, you know, it's considered a lost war.
Nobody wants to be part of a losing war. But if sort of in the judgment of history, 30 years from now, we look back on Iraq and we say that it was a bad idea from the get-go and it's made things worse. Even if that happens, I will still be very proud of going and doing what I could. I was in charge of a platoon of 36 Marines twice over there, and I did everything in my power to keep them alive. And I'm glad that I went and did that, and I'm glad that nobody else went in my place.
Did you lose men?
I didn't. I was very, very lucky, mm-hmm. Thanks, quite frankly, to some unbelievable medical care, because I had at least two who the prognosis was not good, but they ended up pulling through. Mm-hmm. And so I was very lucky in that respect. I certainly saw a lot of Marines and soldiers who were not as lucky as the guys in my platoon.
Well, of course, I have to ask you, Seth, do stories like that and the others that we've been seeing lately, do they frighten you at all? Do they give you second thoughts?
Sure, I'm no hero. You know, I want to go there and serve, and I want to come back in one piece. And Iraq is a frightening place. So, sure, I'm a little nervous about going. But, you know, it's something I think that's it's worth it. It's worth the risk. It's important enough to me that I'm willing to take that risk.
You've been accepted to pursue a joint master's degree at Harvard through the business school and the Kennedy School of Government. Putting that on hold?
Right. Now. They're going to defer me for next year.
How's your family feel about that?
In terms of putting grad school on hold, mm-hmm. I mean, they don't really care about grad school. They just don't want to see me go back to Iraq because they're worried about me. You know, this is a fourth time. I mean, it's not easy for families like this. This is something people forget. I think that so many Americans are glad that we don't have a draft like Vietnam. But, you know, in Vietnam, soldiers went and served their 13-month tour and they were done. And now there's a very few Americans who have to go back again and again. And the burden really falls unfairly on a very small segment of the population. And in my case, you know, my family is bearing the brunt of it.
Did that ever shake your conviction, you know, that I can't do this
I think
to
it,
my parents?
I think it did, actually.
Yeah.
It did. It made it much harder to go back.
But
I still think it's worth it.
You mentioned, you know, a small percentage. About 1% of Americans are fighting in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But, the others who aren't might say, well, that's your choice. Somebody might say, this is something I don't believe in, or, you know, there's a list of
sure.
reasons why people don't.
And I understand that. I am not an advocate for draft
yeah.
where everyone, you know, so many Americans have to serve in the military. I am an advocate for a national service program where, you know, young Americans would have a lot of opportunities to serve their country, of which the military is just one of many options. But I also think there's something to be said for just having some national leadership that calls people to serve and says that it's important. And that has really never happened in this war. I meet an awful lot of Americans around places like Boston and Marblehead who honestly seem to want to help, who want to be able to contribute. Maybe not by going down to their recruiter and signing right up, but they want to be a part of this, you know, supposedly very important national issue. And they just don't see the opportunity to do that.
Hmm.
I think that a lot of people my age, a lot of my friends would be willing to serve it if it was just seen as a more normal route, a normal course of action. I mean, I'm among a very small minority of Harvard graduates who serve in the military right now, but that wasn't always the case. You go to Memorial Church and Harvard Yard and look at the walls, and they're just hundreds of Harvard men who served in World War I and World War II because it was seen as an important duty. I think that if military service was just more accepted by communities like Harvard, there would be a lot more people who are willing to make that leap of faith and sign up.
I'm wondering, too, because if it could be because, in your mind, many Americans confuse, as you said, policy with an overriding issue of service.
I think that's true. I didn't sign up for the Marine Corps to support one particular foreign policy. I mean, I signed up to serve. And so, you know, people can look at me and say, well, how can you support this policy you disagree with? But listen, this isn't about, you know, choosing what baseball team to root for. I mean, it's larger than that. And we need people to serve in the military regardless of the policy. I don't know a single soldier or Marine who's been serving in Iraq and sees the war going badly and turns around to his buddies and says, you know what, I quit. You guys keep on fighting and I'm going to go home. It just doesn't work that way. So I think it's very convenient from the outside to say, hey, if you don't agree with the policy, then you shouldn't participate in the war. But it's not that simple when you're a member of the service. And at a time when the war is going poorly, that's actually when, you know, we need more people to sign up, including people who do disagree with the policy.
Marine Captain Seth Moulton, a reservist, set to deploy for his fourth tour of duty in Iraq this summer. He's volunteered for that deployment. And Seth, as you know, we wish you well.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Well, before the hour ends, the things they carry into battle include a video camera. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, let's take a few minutes to hear some of your thoughts. We spoke this week with Dr. Tim Johnson about the new birth control pill, Libral, which is said to completely eliminate menstrual periods. The FDA just approved the drug, despite concerns from some women that it's unnatural. Well, Catherine from North Carolina wrote, "Because of my hectic schedule, I've been taking birth control pills continually, no break for a period, for 30 years, with no ill effect. On the contrary, I have none of the problems that afflict my friends. No mood swings, cramps, never a questionable pap." She writes, "Glad to hear medicine is catching up." Last week, Here Now's Deborah Becker spoke to an immigrant who's been living in the country illegally since 1994. He objected to paying the $5,000 fine proposed in the new immigration plan from Congress. Well, that prompted Lisa Stowell of Derry, New Hampshire to write, "People like him are exactly why a lot of us, legal or naturalized Americans, are very much against amnesty in any way. He wants the benefits without paying for them. The people I feel sorry for are the ones putting their time, money, and energy into doing the paperwork and even now waiting to become citizens. I think we should at least get them cut rates on attorneys and filing fees, if nothing more." Yesterday, we spoke with New York Times reporter Damien Cave, embedded with the Army's 10th Mountain Division in their search for missing soldiers in Iraq. We made Daniel Denver of Portland, Oregon, very uncomfortable when both Damien and I remarked that these soldiers have no choice but to look for their comrades.
Actually, to me, that seems like a really unfortunate waste of other lives if lots of more soldiers are dying looking for three, now two, missing soldiers. Also, I think it really points out some of the problems with the supposed objectivity of embedded reporters. The problem with having embedded reporters is that you lose all sense of objectivity. You become naturally tied to the perspective of the people who are responsible for keeping you alive.
While staying with the military, we also reported on soldiers losing custody of their kids after deployment to Iraq. Deborah Becker spoke with Master Sergeant Jane Payor, who said the courts had designated her as the primary caregiver before she went to war. She transferred temporary custody to her ex-husband while she was deployed, and when she came back from Iraq, a judge ruled that she would have to split custody with her husband. Well, Linda Quinn from East Northport, Long Island, wrote, "While I sympathize with Master Sergeant Jane Payor's feeling of loss, it should not be a given that the mother gets full custody. If the father has shared custody, the kids don't have to be fully uprooted if Sergeant Payor is deployed again. And what happens if she's reassigned to another state or country and brings her family? Should the court allow the children to go and be separated from their father? There are no set answers to these questions." Carol Rasmussen of Hickory, North Carolina, wrote, "After Dr. Sharon Levine of Boston Medical Center made the impassioned case for training more geriatricians to meet the demand of an aging population." Carol writes, "I sat in my car to the last minute listening to your story. I'm a nurse specializing in rehabilitation, and most of my patient population is elderly. We as a society tend to forget their wisdom. We desperately need more Dr. Levines to holistically care for them. I've forwarded your story to my daughter, who's going to be a nurse practitioner working with the elderly. Thank you." And lastly, Rachel Lair from Warner, New Hampshire, wrote and asked about a piece of music we played after a segment on the history of India's Taj Mahal. She writes, "That tiny snippet of ethereal music still echoes in my head." Well, ours too, but we have to enlist our colleague Hitesh Hathi for an assist. Hitesh, what was that song?
The title, which is the first line, goes, "Khabare dehe yure ishq sun, na junu raha na pari rahi, na to tu raha, na to main raha. When I first heard the news of the wonder that is love, neither the madman remained nor the fairy," meaning neither the lover nor the beloved, "neither you remained nor I. All that remained was a state of unknowing," which captures beautifully this very particularly Indian developed notion of a love, which is a state which transcends any worldly category, including the category of lover and beloved.
Well, I'm not going to repeat the title, but you can find it and more about the songwriter at our website, here-now.org, where you can also write to us at letters@here-now.org or call 617-358-0397. Back after a quick break with the Soldier Filmmakers, Here and Now.
Na junoon raha na pari rahi.
As the Memorial Day weekend begins, we thought we'd take another look at a film in which soldiers document their own lives. That's the sound of a raid in Fallujah in Iraq in November of 2004. Earlier that year, filmmaker Deborah Scranton gave video cameras to members of New Hampshire's National Guard. She asked them to tape their lives in Iraq, from the mundane tasks to the sudden attacks. The result is The War Tapes, which is now out on DVD. We spoke with Deborah and two of the soldiers in the film, Michael Moriarty and Zach Batzi, when the film was shown in theaters last year. We started by asking Mike and Zach for their reaction when they were asked to take a camera on their missions.
Oh, no.
Really?
Zach here. I actually recall this pretty clearly. Deborah Scranton came to the unit, and she stood in front of the entire company and basically articulated her vision. And she gave us a promise, and she said basically if we chose to participate in her endeavor, the final product will be kind of unfiltered, raw representation of what we did in Iraq, but with no political lens or ideological kind of leaning to it.
Well, I'll tell you, watching it, Deborah, one of the feelings I came away with was claustrophobia. I mean, a lot of the film is shot from within the vehicles. You went through, 900 hours of tape. What feelings did you come away with?
For me, it was about trying to get as close to the experience of war as possible, to climb inside. And the guys did an amazing job of mounting, you know, the tripods on the dashboard of their Humvees, on the gun turrets. We had a few POV cameras that they would mount on their Kevlar as well as a thermal imaging camera. And they just dedicated themselves so much to take us along day in and day out to, you know, give us this great gift.
Mike, one of the things that came out, at least from your tape, is, well, feelings about KBR, the Kellogg Brown and Root, the subsidiary of Halliburton. This is the company that Vice President Dick Cheney has had close ties to and does a lot of the private contracting in Iraq. I want to listen to a segment when you speak pretty critically of these private contractors. Let's listen.
When you're out there, you start to think about reality, and the reality is, why the f*** am I sitting here guarding this truck full of cheesecake? Are these people crazy? I feel like the priority of KBR making money outweighs the priority of safety.
You find yourself in the middle of the night in a very hostile territory watching a truck for several hours that's disabled waiting for recovery assets, only to find out that the truck is full of things like cheesecake and DVDs. And then you ask yourself, what the hell am I doing? My kids are sitting at home waiting for me to get back.
Zach, you had a particular relationship with the people in Iraq. You're originally from Lebanon. Deborah, you cut back and forth between the guys in the field and their family back home. And in the film, Zach's mother talks about how you, Zach, joined the army so that you could get money for college, that she took you away from Lebanon to keep you safe, and that you ended up in Iraq. She's pretty broken up about that. But what did your speaking the language? We see scenes where you're speaking the language with the people there. How did that give you a different interaction?
It allowed me, at a personal level, it was a vehicle for empathy and sympathy with Iraqi people. And more importantly, though, from a tactical infantry, soldier perspective, it allowed me to do my job in a more efficient, more effective way.
At one point in the film, you talk about not wanting to translate some orders that were given to these civilians because the orders didn't make any sense to you.
The squad would come up to me, hey, well, tell this guy he can't take his sick baby to the hospital. I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to do that. Just you tell him. We're just following orders. I know, but I don't want to translate. If the colonel wants to do it, he can come down himself and do it. It goes in against why we're there. It goes against a lot of our beliefs and the value system we operate under as American soldiers. What's interesting about this incident is a couple days later, our battalion commander came down and he was driving up and down that road, talking to troops, you know, Thanksgiving Day type thing, asking them about their morale. And as far as I can recall, almost every soldier told him how this order at our level made no sense, how it, you know, inhumane. If anything, it's making insurgents out of otherwise ordinary people. So that to me was awesome, how a lot of the soldiers had this, you know, amazing capability to empathize and sympathize with the Iraqis and let the chain of command know about sometimes lack of wisdom in their orders.
Both Zach and Mike and Deborah, as you looked at these pictures,
it could go, for hours of what seemed like, just boring, mundane life. I mean, at one point, I think it's Zach who photographed trucks carrying septic waste and emptying the septic waste, unloading their cargo.
Streams of poop water. We are bringing democracy and good vegetation to Iraq.
And then in the next second, because the cameras are in the vehicles.
Are we on fire?
Deborah, did you find yourself cutting those things next to each other? Is that really how life happened?
It's a 360-degree war. As soon as they lock and load and leave the wire or leave the base, they are the front lines. And there's no way of knowing when that instant is, when an IED is going to go off or a V-bid's going to hit or you're going to get attacked. There is just no way to know. And it did come out of nowhere.
I think by definition, no medium can ever capture authentically war, but you can attempt. I think this movie, more than any others I've seen, is as close as it's going to get. It captures some of the psychological essence of it, the fact that, they're using guerrilla tactics on a traditional force, and a lot of it is just ultimately, no matter how hard you train, if that insurgent decided to pull the fuse when your Humvee drove by, your time is up.
Well, Mike, we know you joined up in the aftermath of September 11th, and yet it feels in the end as if you've become somewhat disillusioned. Let's listen to one scene in particular and then talk about
it. It's so hard to look at things in a positive light as far as Iraq goes. Whenever anything happens that's positive, they all get excited, and it doesn't last for any length of time. Eventually, they'll be shooting at us again.
Mike, how do you look back and look at that film, which forces you to look back on your service in Iraq?
Now when I look back on it, I know that we made progress, and I know that we are making progress in Iraq. My frustrations mostly pertains to infrastructure. We would spend millions of dollars restoring a turbine power plant that was damaged back in the early 90s, and it would be up and running, and you would think, geez, this is great. All right, these people are going to start to see the benefits of us being in their country. And then, a few weeks later, the insurgents would blow the thing up. As a human being, that's unmotivating.
Zach Batsy, will you be going back to Iraq?
Well, I'm still in. Actually been recently promoted to staff sergeant. If they ask me to go, of course, it's not an option, nor should it be an option for me.
What do you say to your mom?
This wasn't my first deployment. I've already been deployed to Bosnia and Kosovo with the 101st Airborne Division. So she knows the drill. I think, regardless of the political context of certain wars and foreign policies and so on, being in the Army is something that's been very beneficial for me over the years. And I feel a great deal of loyalty for the Army.
That's Zach Batsy, Mike Moriarty, and filmmaker Deborah Scranton speaking last year about their film The War Tapes, which is now out on DVD. This update, Mike Moriarty has left the New Hampshire National Guard. He now works for the city of Keene, New Hampshire. Zach Batsy was recently deployed to Afghanistan for a year-long tour. Listen to music from the film The War Tapes as we hear that Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashla, Katesh Hati, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. He's assisted today by Vince Fairchild. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns Huda Ahmed, Chris Cuff, Gina Petruccelli, Emily Reddy, and Charlie Bridge. Our managing editor Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Have a great, maybe grateful for some, Memorial Day weekend. Please join us again Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.